Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another man who has gone on his journey and is willing to share his journey as he talks with us today. Today is clearly no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Harold Jonas. Dr. Jonas is a professional psychotherapist with many, many years of experience, and he's also an expert in the area of application and web development. Dr. Jonas, welcome to Mind Talk.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Now, clearly you wear a few hats, psychotherapist, web development, and an entrepreneur, so you're kind of busy.
That I am, and very diversified as well in my interests. And I'm very happy to be here and share some of that journey for people who may be listening to get some hope that they too can follow their dreams and achieve their goals.
Well, that was one of the things that really struck me about your story. So let's sort of get started with your personal story, because you truly have traveled a complicated road yourself, shall we say. Tell us a little bit about your history. The applications that you've developed and the work that you do is in what area?
Primarily in substance abuse, and that's, you know, my whole life has been either observing people using drugs myself, or now, and for a period of time, a pretty lengthy period of time, in a recovery process from that kind of long history of being a product of my generation, shall we say.
Well,
go ahead.
Give us a sense of how you began to use drugs. What was going on in your life, and what were you using at the time?
Ironically, this just came up just at Thanksgiving, because we were reminiscing, my sister and I, as we shared Thanksgiving this year, of Thanksgiving's past, growing up in our home where marijuana was basically introduced at the table. And this was, gosh, back in the 70s, 74, 75, and I had already been actively using since the age of 12. And for me, my family, my parents both used alcohol. And alcohol was not a substance that, even though it was introduced to me at an early age, probably 7 or 8 years old, as an annual ritual from my father, who would make us a highball, but that's what the terms back then in the 60s, for New Year's Eve and to celebrate New Year's Eve and so forth. I could never really get that substance into my body because it made me nauseous and it was very revolting. So once I was introduced to marijuana at like 12, 13 years old, I really latched on and became a part of my family, because there was all of the incidents of using in the family system, and this is what people did, and this is how you feel a part of and connected. And that journey of using substances evolved for, you know, the next 20 years. And as they say, marijuana is a gateway drug. For me, it was the door that opened up, where I would then try any number of different substances that were available. And again, we're talking about the heyday of the 70s, where culture was like, yes, there's no holds barred. And I mean, that included amphetamines and cocaine and hallucinogens and sedatives and barbiturates and any number of things that were available that I used. And until there, towards the end of my active using, I wound up settling on a very long analgesic kind of drug because of the psychic pain, the emotional pain, my own pain of failure and sense of failure and not connecting and not feeling really adequate, shall we say, in the core sense of my being. And with the drugs always made that go away. I wound up an active heroin addict at age 28 and deteriorated very quickly from upper middle class background with already now at that point at 28 a pending failed marriage looking at me, my third failed business looking at me at 28, and it took me in the colorful sense of the world to living in this on the streets on a piece of cardboard.
So you really went from one end of the spectrum, middle class family, to absolutely 360 the other end of the spectrum. What which is the story for so many people who are using drugs. And it's interesting to hear you refer to marijuana as a gateway drug. As you know, so many people say that it is, and so many people say that it isn't. But certainly for you, it was.
Yeah, and, you know, that's to be a determining factor, I think, for every individual, because a lot of people now with the legalization movement, and I remember when normalization started to become a movement back in the 70s, I remember hanging a big picture of a kilo of marijuana pulled out of the High Times magazine as this is what I was going to, you know, kind of strive to be an active part of throughout my lifespan. And it got to the point where, for my using, I didn't want to actually leave the house without using something to face the world. And I really didn't think that there are people that did that. I mean, I really believe that, you know, why would they when you could do this? So, you know, I had really got this ingrained. And as far as the gateway, it would just let my defenses down to be more curious. But that kind of rolls into my risk-taking behavior and my entrepreneurial kind of attitude of risk-taking, which, of course, every entrepreneur has to have and have some containment and management skills of that healthy or calculated risk-taking. So that's just all part of that whole character and personality makeup.
Again, it's interesting because what you describe is truly being at the bottom of the social structure in terms of the impact of your multiple drug use on your physical and emotional self. And yet, here you are today, your life is very different. What caused you to begin to turn around?
Let's see. I think that once you start, a person starts to inject drugs into their system, there's not really a lot of denial that there's a problem in your life. I'd been told for many years by my mother that I was addicted, and I really believed that you couldn't be addicted to marijuana. And every other drug I used was recreational in nature. The addiction from what I would consider, oh, I was just using and I was a recreational and functional drug user, to becoming an addict was when I crossed this line that I had made up, you know, because addicts have a tendency to make up rules for themselves. And if I cross this line, you know, I'm just going to extend that rule a little bit further and reevaluate and make a new rule for myself. Like, you know, alcoholics have a tendency to, if I don't drink before 5 o'clock, then I can't be an alcoholic, you know, for instance, because that's cocktail hour and that's socially acceptable. Well, for me, it was that rule was if I ever become like my primary role model in our family system who injected drugs, then I crossed the line and I became an addict. So, and that's what happened. And he was the one that assisted in that transformation, ironically, who was, you know, a first cousin of mine who had grown up in the early 60s in the late Beat generation and somehow survived as an active addict throughout his lifespan, almost age 64 before he finally did, you know, expire. So for me, that the failures and the core sense of inadequacy, which I didn't know wasn't identified as that, but I know it was something wrong. There was no doubt that I was powerless over the drugs, because that's what drugs are supposed to do anyway. It was the accompanying unmanageability of my life that I had no clue about. I thought that was a victim. I was a victim. I was a victim of circumstance and not poor decision making and so forth. So that's how that attitude kind of continued to get nurtured inside of me.
When you began to enter into your recovery, what did you do? Did you go to 12-step meetings? Were you inpatient? Were you outpatient? Did you try to do it on your own? How did you approach recovery?
I started going to make attempts in 1985. Now, I was at that time 30 or 31 years old. Recognizing there was a problem, I went to a 12-step meeting, and I had just got onto my first methadone clinic. And I thought this was the greatest thing in the world. This was, you know, I went to a meeting and basically announced that I had not used any drugs that day. And in 1985, the attitude, and even in some pockets still, of a 12-step meeting, and I hope I didn't mention WIT fellowship. I'm not sure what I did or didn't, but they told me to come back. They told me to come back when I was drug free, and I left incredibly devastated because I didn't feel welcome. And I then proceeded for another 2 years to go even further into the the pit of despair with more severe consequences and more exposure to elements that, you know, I only had read about or seen in the movies. And I became that person living on the street and was unemployable and very challenging. And it wasn't until my father, who had essentially disappeared from my life for had been the last 5 years or 6 years, showed up at a job I had and offered me a way out. And all he asked me to do was try my hardest. And that was enough. And I got on a plane. I was living in Camden, New Jersey, which is, you know, a really dilapidated city in terms of today. Mm-hmm. It's a smaller kind of vision of a very large, poor socioeconomic kind of demographic, et cetera. I wound up getting on a plane going to Florida and entering into treatment centers after having made like 13 failed attempts to change prior to, from 1985 to 1987. Trying different methods, all the things that anybody would reach for, knowing there's a problem and looking for a solution. And I wasn't able to sustain any of that until I got on that plane and came here and tried my hardest. And once I learned that there was another way and I could learn to live drug-free and leave the house drug-free and function and not get smothered and swallowed up and overwhelmed, I was on the road because I was aching for that solution. I had already been seeking different methods, and none of them, I can't say the methods had failed, but I was, you know, I wasn't really, it wasn't time yet for whatever reason, and how that cymbals bang and karma occurs in people's lives, and suddenly the teacher appears and off you go. And that's how it happened for me.
It's interesting to hear you say that you tried 13 times before you were able to find something that worked for you and you were willing to work with it. And what that brings up, for those who are listening, I would think, is a sense of hope that no matter how many times you believe you have tried and failed, you can try again, and there is the potential for succeeding at that which you are interested in pursuing.
Pretty much. And you get really hopeless when you're out there. You get
Absolutely.
Really hopeless, and that light, you know, the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel is not hope anymore. It's a train coming at you. And it's that whole reverse kind of belief system and perception of things, and what I call and now learned as addictive logic. Everything is convoluted. So when that hand reached out and I was willing to whatever false ego I had and all the fears that I lived with and all the shame that I had, you know, done such horrible things and I was such a horrible person and I didn't deserve anything was extended to me. With a lot of trepidation and fear of failure, accepted that. And then again, once that door opened up and I wound up in a 12-step meeting and I felt at home. And I was just at a meeting yesterday where I was sharing this. And then I got there and I was home. There were people there. There were misfits like I was. There were people that didn't belong anywhere except where they were. And I was welcomed. And I was welcomed and told that if I kept coming back, that I could get better. And that if I didn't use drugs for one day, that I was a success. And that was, those were new words to me. Those were new words to me because my successes were measured by material things and other people's values and credit and a visual sense that, you know, look at me, look at my appearance, and that makes me a success. When in fact, success was getting redefined.
That is such an important piece, I think, for many people in all walks of life to have the opportunity to take a look at their definition of success and perhaps take a look at redefining it. Because it's true that so many people, certainly in this country, really define success based on what you own and who you know and to some extent what you do, but it's really what you own, what you look like on the outside. You were really, it sounds like, powerfully impacted upon by that meeting at that 12-step program. Walk us, if you will, through the journey from then to where you are now, a successful entrepreneur, a web developer, and a therapist. How did you get here?
That journey started One of the things that happens when you take away the drugs is, aside from all the negotiating of all the shame and moving towards shedding that shame through a process of going from shame to guilt, some reawakened dreams started to pop into my consciousness. And it was really early on, and I had a phenomenal talent. I really did have an incredible talent for vision. And this story really unfolds when I was kind of really pushed to go to college as an 18-year-old that was lost and really stuck on drugs even then, and by my father, whose value was education, education, education. You'll do much better in life, and you'll make a lot more money in life if you learn to use your head. And he stuck with me, and talk about patience as a parent, a man who had no parenting skills on any measure, but knew that education was and he pushed it. So I failed out my first semester majoring in drugs and girlfriends, that first semester at a small liberal arts college, and he pushed me to go back again in the next semester, and this is like 1973, and I found myself in the theater department. And when I say that, that's a real complete sentence. And when I say I found myself, I wound up getting ensconced in the theater department, and finding a talent to read and interpret plays, and being able to hone a craft as a director, more so than as an actor or a technician with building scenery and all the other things that go with it. But really being able to identify people's skill set and get the most out of them while they performed on stage. And you might, as a therapist, we look at that word manipulation or control. It was really about taking something from concept to reality and putting it out there when the curtain opened and impacting people. And my mission at that point had become education through entertainment. And I wanted to pursue a graduate degree, and I wasn't mature enough emotionally to be able to handle rejection. Criticism, there was no separation for me as a person from behavior. It was all integrated. So when people were critical of anything that I said or did, it wasn't for that attitude or belief or depiction of what I put on stage, but it was really about me as a person. And I didn't have any separation skills. So with that said, what theater taught me was everything I needed to learn in life, in terms of business and in relationships and vision and follow through. And it was just an amazing, amazing experience for 4 straight years. And it kind of put that in my pocket. But that popped up again when I got into recovery. And it popped up in doing live theater as a therapist. And I wound up getting directed and steered into becoming a counselor, and being a, because the only 2 goals I ever identified in high school was to be a social worker or be a teacher, because they kind of forced us to make a decision at that point during that whole identity crisis at 16, 17 years old. And I was like, okay, here's an answer. Leave me alone. And I came back to those two because they meant something to me. Those two identified professions of being a teacher or being a therapist, or it was like, okay, fine, it evolved to becoming a therapist here in my early 30s and pursuing my graduate degree then, because I didn't follow through in my early 20s. I kind of got sidetracked with other people's values again, primarily my role model being my father, and seeking approval and wanting to be like him and take over the family business and blah, 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 blah. And then becoming true to myself and pursuing that dream of fulfillment of a graduate degree, which of course meant it meant something. Having a graduate degree meant something. It's a professional kind of training that you had, that work career that had been like poisonous as a teenager. Most teenagers will hear that word career and they'll say, this is what I'm going to be pigeonholed to do the rest of my life, until some things came along and gave people permission to change. So this is what happened to me. At the same time, simultaneously, and I know I'm kind of going on here, I met the woman of my soulmate. I met my soulmate in one of these meetings, and this is a great story. I don't know if you want to kind of dive divert here a little bit, but it was a very...
Let me ask you to do this. What I'd like to do is to take a break, and then when we come back, I'd like to hear the story. Are you up for it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We'll take a break, folks, and we'll be right back. I am having a conversation with Dr. Harold Jonas. We are discussing his life, and his life has taken so many amazing twists and turns that I want you to stay right where you are. We'll be back in just a moment and hear about the next important turn in the life of Dr. Harold Jonas. Don't go away. Dr. Jonas, you met the love of your life, your soulmate. Tell us that story.
Okay, this is classic Hollywood.
Okay.
And you can't write it. Okay, I guess you could write a better story because in Hollywood, they're pretty creative out there. So I'm going to one of these meetings, and this cousin I mentioned previously had actually followed me to Florida because my father was very generous, and I was actually named after my cousin's father who had passed away, and my father was his surrogate father. So long story short, we go to a meeting together, and in the front of the meeting and part of oftentimes meetings is people will do a testimonial and share their story. That's how it's referred to. So in the front of the room is this very, very attractive blonde, which of course got my attention because now I'm recently divorced from my first failed marriage, which is another Hollywood story. So I'm in the meeting, and here's this, I'm paying attention because of what I see. And after the meeting, I go to talk with her because she had mentioned that she was from Philadelphia, which is my home city where I grew up. So I'm engaging with her. My cousin kind of walks up, and I've been referred to by my last name for many, many years. If you'll call me Jonas. And so he said something about, let's go, Jonas, or something. And this woman says to me, wait a second. What did you say your name was? And she looked at me a little closer, and suddenly there was this recognition that came across her face, and she said, I know you. Your name's Harold. Your name's Harold Jonas. Are you so-and-so? And I looked at her, and I said, yeah. And she said, didn't you go to this camp as a child? And we all went to a summer camp outside of Philadelphia in the mountains. I said, yeah. And she said, well, I'm so-and-so. My name's Dawn. And my name's Dawn Doctor. And I'm like, wow. And I was like, and then you could just feel, you know, and people in life that don't get to experience this. It's like these symbols just kind of, you know, mash in your brain and in your whole, in my being. And because there was the mutuality of that happening was just not, I don't know how to describe it.
It's pretty amazing.
We were talking. And so here she was. Now we're talking 23 years later. She says to me during that conversation, you're the first boy I ever kissed. And she was 7 years old and remembers that. And then that's what she said to me. And I was 9 at the time and bunkmates with her brother. And so we sparred around and danced around our intense attraction to one another because I was very early in this process. I was recently divorced. I didn't really know which end was up. I was 5 or 6 months into like living drug free for the first time in 20 years, but I couldn't like let that whole exchange just go. We were like magnets. It was really uncanny that it was so intense for both of us. And then we decided to try to make a go of it and work with other people to nurture this relationship and not ruin it because neither of us had a really good history of doing relationships well. As far as nurturing them and not burning them out and being self-centered and so forth. And so long story short, we wound up engaging. in June of 1988 and proceeded to work towards a satisfactory and mutually beneficial kind of union and got married in August of 1989. And even though today there's some changes in our relationship as we speak, as far as the evolution of things 28 years later, there's still a civil kind of communication that's currently happening with some work and some residence change, shall we say, to make it, you know, even more palatable, so to speak. And this is all very new, but also very doable, that I'm comfortable to share, and that we're moving ahead. So, because the love is still there, you know, regardless of all the other differences that people maybe grow apart as they age and different life changes and lifespan issues, et cetera, there's still that core kind of bond that just doesn't get broken. It may get stretched, but never broken. So those two incidences in the early 30s of meeting her and identifying my dream and goal of becoming a professional in a career, which happened to evolve into being a therapist, kind of simultaneously occurred, and off we went together and built a family, raised kids from my first marriage together, et cetera, and really both mutually had a value that we clung to, which was the love of family and unconditional love in a family system, which neither of us really felt that we had grown up with.
It's just, it really is a Hollywood story. And it's one of those things that if you see it on television or in the theater, you assume it's a story. But for you, it was real life.
And it still is. I mean, it's still real life on life's terms, as we like to say, in a recovery process and dealing with life on life's terms and going with it as it will take you and managing good decision making and follow through and doing the best to stay spiritual through all of the changes that life has to offer and true to yourself, most importantly. So
now, yes, you were
what drove
say.
Me right around then is that I can't afford to support a family as a therapist. I can't afford to support a family and make the goals of braces and cars. As I have four children, and you know the economics of that, and wanting them as parents to have it better than we did, and have the love and self esteem and a different pathway than we went on. So we had drug-free home, both of us, and that's what we kind of stayed with, and both of us are still active in that process in exposing our kids to nothing but our journey as well, which can also have a challenge as far as their evolution as they grow. So you were going to say, I kind of interrupted.
No, what you had to say was very important, so I'm glad that you finished that thought. At some point, you moved towards working with web development. Now, you said you had four children. That is certainly a financial commitment of immense proportions. How about we put it that way? Was
yes.
that what drove you into working, doing web development and becoming an entrepreneur in that area? Or talk about that.
Well, where that story picks up is in you know, I'm struggling along trying to make ends meet, and we're living at or near poverty line and accumulating massive debt with student loans for graduate school, and I'm working two jobs and going to school, really driven because I'm trying to make up for 20 years of lost time that had gone up in smoke, literally up in smoke and in my arm. So I'm trying to condense all this in a very short amount of time. So I'm working, you know, excessive amounts of hours to meet a goal, which is to be able to earn enough money. And I got a consulting job, and I did a job for another person in terms of opening a sober house, which is, you know, a shared supportive living. And that came for me from doing transitional housing with domestic violence victims, et cetera. So there was that aching of, oh, you're too early in recovery to go in business. Don't do it. Learn the ropes, learn how to work in organizations, learn rules. This was all new to me because I didn't do that. I don't have any clue on how to not work with authority figures without an immense amount of contempt. You know, I had all these things that I didn't even know about. So I do this consulting job, and I say, look, if he can do this, and this is a person that didn't have a resume. I'm sure that I can do this. So I go and find myself an apartment building, and then I plunk down a down payment that I didn't have, and figured I'm going to be able to get a mortgage that they laughed at, and I'm at risk. And we found somebody in a Baby and Me class. Dawn actually found somebody who was willing to help co-sign for the mortgage and finance this project. And it was a very gentlemanly agreement. I didn't know this person, but they were willing to do it because their risk was secured by real estate.
Okay.
And that made it okay for them. And he was a real estate guy, so it was like a no-brainer. He's like, this is great, this is it, blah, blah, blah. So we open our first recovery residence, and what happens there is that people are non-compliant because addicts use drugs. We're getting them coming post-treatment and giving them a clean and nice place to live so they can start their journey of change and recovery and growth. And unfortunately, they regress, or they don't move from regression, and they continue to use drugs. So they have to – it's a drug-free environment. That's the agreement. They have to go somewhere else. I'm trying to refer them to places that don't exist because there's no directory. All this is underground. There's no recognized industry for halfway houses and sober houses, not only in our community but in the country. And I get this idea that what about a directory on the internet? And I start right there by securing domain names for this directory project, which essentially is an electronic telephone book, if you will, that people can go shopping for their best clinical and financial fit. And I was able to continue to expand on that and diversify from one domain name to multiple domain names to securing the one that I currently have, which is called sober.com, S-O-B-E-R, sober.com. And it grew to a full continuum of care. So you can go shopping for anything related to recovery and addictions on that one domain address and find what you need. And we were able to get all these listings. And then I used an advertising model to support this. As that evolved, I'm like, there's not enough traffic. There's not enough traffic. People are only on the site for a couple of seconds. They get what they need and leave. We want to keep them there. And I'm a clinician. What can we do to fit this together? And in 2004, I start kicking around telemedicine, which like was very, very early phases because we're looking at 56K modems, you know, T1 lines and,
yes.
And broadband. It was still, it wasn't even, they were thinking of it because, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on that we don't know about, but they were already, it was in place in certain areas of the country. And I started to put this electronic coaching, live coaching on the internet in chat rooms and forums and getting people to email us. And then I said, well, I need coaches. So I had to create a curriculum for these coaches. So we started to train coaches and then pay them to be available to give service to people for free. And then we were paying them from the advertising revenue. So it was the beginning of the social capitalism that we learned. I had no idea because I didn't even know I was hanging off the curve yet. I didn't even understand any of those terms because I never went to business school. I'm a therapist. I'm a human service professional that's like following my dream of being able to impact a lot of people with little to no cost. I'm like, this is fantastic. What a great idea. And then what? The industry changed, which I heard about, and things occur in life. And they invented this thing called Google. And Google changed the landscaping of the advertising dollar considerably for our business. And we butted heads internally because it evolved to becoming, they wanted to do lead gen. My sales team wanted to do lead generation and then do evaluations and place people in facilities. And essentially what we would identify as human trafficking or in a sense, and you know, that you're not allowed to do that in Florida under the law. You can't, like, you know, sell referrals, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
So we had to part ways. The team that I had, they were, like, really gung-ho on this, and I let them go. And so sales deteriorated. My passion for the project kind of started to wane because of the reduced revenues and the heyday of it all kind of seemed to have passed us by, and I didn't find a way to continue to make that occur, you know, and keep it going. I kind of lost it. As I had opened up another business for the community, we opened up a coffee house in the adjacent property to where the office was, and we had a big, basically, non-alcoholic nightclub occurring in our community, which at the height of it was recognized on the front page of the New York Times. That addition is in 2007. In November of 2007, there was my coffee house on the front page of the New York Times talking about addiction and recovery in South Florida and in Delray Beach.
Amazing.
And got a lot of publicity and got a lot of calls, but didn't get a lot of embracing from the community leaders here because they weren't real thrilled with being called the recovery capital of the country.
Okay.
And me being in the front of it, you know, and stuff. And it wasn't the intent. We were just trying to provide a service. We were just trying to make a living. We were just trying to basically sell a property by opening a showcase coffee house and adjacent to the motel that I had somehow gotten into, and which evolved to being a place where people came and overdosed. And I was just, it's a number of different things that were happening, juggling all at the same time.
The expansiveness with which you think, I mean, it really comes through because, you go from one idea to the next. And even if you find yourself stopped with one idea, that doesn't stop you from coming up with another idea. Tell us more about Sober.com. That's a site that anyone can go to.
Sober.com is an internet directory where anybody can go to. It's free for the user to go in and find information. We encourage people to sign up as members as we continue to develop more services for our members. We have a forums in there. We want to put in some live coaching in there. What happened was, you know, with the deterioration of the sales and the morale of the staff, I sold a significant portion of it to another company that wanted to operate it. And just recently, a year ago, well, about 18 months ago now, I just bought back my shares that I sold to rebuild the site and rebuild the business and to use that as a platform, so to speak, to launch all the apps, which now segue into the sober systems that I had mentioned earlier of getting traffic to come to the site and giving away that free coaching. I call that Project Sober Systems. And trademarked this thing, and it was all branded and like, oh yeah, it's Sober Systems. And then as the site traffic deteriorated, and it continued to go down, I then let the project go and then came back to it in 2011 and put it in a mobile device. The same concept of being able to connect with people, because that's what we saw. People were using their iPhones. And they weren't talking anymore. The population in the coffee house, they weren't talking to each other. They were texting to one another and sending pictures to one another. I'm like, what the heck is going on?
It's true.
And I have to figure this out because this is the new, this is where it's going to be. Everything's going to be in the palm of your hand. And I don't know if you remember the early technology of Palm Pilots and stuff. I had gotten the Dell computer and a little handheld thing. And every time, if you didn't charge it up every night, all your data was erased. And I'm like, oh God, that's terrible. It was just so cumbersome. But I, again, just to interject something, there were three goals I had in those treatment centers that I went to in 1987. They asked us to identify three goals, and you'll get a kick out of this because I was so somewhere else. And they said, well, you need to give me three goals. So, and I love to tell this story. I put down, I wanted to learn how to type. I wanted to learn how to juggle. And I wanted to learn how to speak Spanish. Those are the three goals identified in my treatment center. And they looked at me. They looked at me and they said, what is this? What are you telling? What is this? And we'll never, ever stay sober. You can't. These aren't sobriety goals. I said, what do you mean? These are goals that are going to help me get through life. These are important things. And we had a big conflict, of course. And subsequently, they asked me to leave because I was fighting with them, even 2 weeks drug free. And I did learn to teach myself to type, and I did teach myself to juggle, and I'm still teaching myself how to speak Spanish more fluently, which is still really a far distant goal because of my other things. But those things, those core things that I looked at then, I implemented, and they've served me well because juggling is not limited to juggling balls like a circus clown, but all the different roles that you had said earlier in our interview or in our conversation, I should say, of all of the different things I'm doing in diversification and juggling. And sometimes, as you see, the ball drops. And it's not the dropping of the ball. It's the picking up of the ball and keeping going and starting again and recovery, because it's a very generic word.
Absolutely. Dr. Jonas, mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to really dive into all of the things that you're doing on the internet today.
Great. Thank you.
Folks, don't go away. We'll be back in a moment and hear more about the amazing things that Dr. Harold Jonas is creating. Dr. Jonas, in 2012, when you designed and launched Sober Systems, the goal was to increase compliance and reduce recidivism for substance abuse treatment. What's happening with Sober Systems today as we speak?
So Sober Systems in the name itself was somewhat limiting. So I was a year into the project, and then I re-engaged with a friendly competitor that I had when I was active with the Sober.com website and competing for advertising dollars. And the suggestion was made that we rebrand it, and I didn't need to create a whole new app to rebrand it. So we went through the process. He helped me do that. And we rebranded the app, and we called it the Flex Deck. I came up with this, what I thought was, oh, this is a great name, the Flex Deck. This is a platform, right, a deck that you can use for any medical or behavioral health diagnosis, including substance abuse, to help people stay on that path of compliance with whatever treatment regimen that their physician or their healthcare professional is kind of recommending, whether that be medication, whether that be exercise and diet, whether it be, you know, monitoring through physical apparatus and reporting and so forth. So here's the Flex Deck now, and we're going into the market and banging on doors since 2013 with this new branded product and primarily going to private treatment centers thinking, oh, yo, this would be a great idea, so you can help get that, because statistically and you know, it's been shown that research that people that stay connected with the treatment center they go to, the longer they stay connected, the more likely they are to stay on that path of recovery and do well for themselves and get better. So as a clinician, I'm like, this is the tool. This is what you need. This will be great. You can monitor them and then kind of connect with them as they may falter. And so the treatment center industry is like, yeah, that's a great idea, but if people get better, they won't come back. If people get better, they won't relapse. And then we won't have any reason to be here. I mean, that's the underlying message. So aftercare and afterthought became somewhat synonymous, and I was very disheartened by that. And it's still an ongoing battle. And that's in the private sector because there's no incentive for that client or that patient when they leave to stay connected with that treatment center. There's no real gain for them, and the treatment center is busy trying to get people in the front door, not worried about them leaving out the back door, so to speak, in terms of discharge. So then I turned my attention to where people are mandated to do things. It would be the drug court market, and they can make them do stuff. And if you don't use this app, we're going to basically have consequences. So I'm still banging on that door, dealing with the bureaucratic mess that goes with introducing a new tool and maybe having technology reduce the human effort, you know, and that's very threatening. So that's struggling along as well. And in the interim, I'm like looking at new opportunities and what can I do with this great idea? And there's some competing products and so forth. And then I come up with this idea to enter it into a contest that was sponsored from the pharmaceutical industry called can I mention the manufacturer? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Eli Lilly puts out a call for patient engagement and patient retention in clinical trials. They want new technology. I'm like, what do I know about the pharma industry? All I know is that they make great drugs, right? This is a good idea. So
and a great deal of money.
they make some money. And so I adapt the app, the Flex Deck, and I proof my concept by submitting it to the contest. And what do you think? I get recognized as the grand prize winner. Well, I just thought I was the cat's meow. I mean, I finally arrived. I've got validation for my efforts. Somebody else sees, you know, that I'm not only have a lot of fortitude and patience and perseverance and all the things that are required to be successful. But I'm a pretty smart guy. And so they fly me to Las Vegas and the head of Google Medical Docs or whatever that product was that they put out there and shut down hands me a check and then shakes my hand and says, thank you very much. And I'm in this massive trade show in the pharma industry. And the amount of money in that room that was spent was overwhelming to me. It made the substance abuse industry trade shows that I had been to look like they were playing in the sand. I mean, I was like amazed. So I'm sitting with the vice president of product development at Eli Lilly with eight people that he has on his team. And I turn to him and I say, so let me ask you a real sincere question and honest. What was this about? Because I'm sitting here with some of the brightest people in technology and pharma in your industry. And he says, well, we just wanted to see what was out there and if we can get any good ideas. I said, so the chances of you implementing my product are what, you know, really? He said, slim to none. we can't do this because of all the rules with FDA and so forth, but we have got some good ideas and we appreciate your effort and so forth. And, stay in touch. And I'm like, wow, very, very disheartened by the whole exercise. But not defeated. So I go back to Del Rey and I keep plowing away and beating on doors and not giving up because I'm funding this project out of my pocket. And really determine that I know I'm onto something because I've gotten recognition and validation, and it's a good thing. And people keep saying that, but, and I get that but, and we keep trying to figure it out. Most recently, SAMHSA, which is our national drug control office, it's Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency of the federal government. They put out a call for another mobile technology application to address the opiate addiction epidemic that's sweeping the country. And that was earlier this year. Now this is 2016 or 2016, and I'm like still not making any revenue from this product, a very limited use in certain select treatment centers that are using it. And I'm like, okay, let's do one more. So I retool the app, and we put out another app into the market and into the contest called MAT, medication-assisted treatment. So it's the FlexDoc MAT Edition is what we refer to it as. So now to make this thing even more up-to-date, so to speak, we have the wellness management model, which is the original, and now we have one for MAT and medication-assisted treatment. And it's a free application, and it's available to anybody that wants to download it via their app store from Apple and or their Google Play Store. And what we did was incentivize it or reward people in this application. So if they do what they're supposed to do, the people that use the app, check into the survey items, because that's how it's designed, they can earn rewards. They can earn rewards. They can get a discount medication card from one of the vendors that we got on board with us, or they can get free professional coaching via the app. And that's basically what we're really pushing here, is that addicts that are out there, like you heard, are very hopeless. And they don't have a future, and their dreams are broken, and their goals are non-existent. And so we want me as a person and the team that I have assembled recognize that, because many of them are in recovery. And so we're going to let people use this app for free. We're going to continue to train coaches for free. And in exchange for their free training, ask them for free coaching to the people that use the app, because new coaches have to do an internship in order to meet certification standards. So I've kind of identified this hole in the system where entry-level people can't afford to go to training because they don't make enough money to get out of that, get training to change their careers. So we're going to give those people that opportunity by giving them free training via the internet. We're going to let them do a 6-month internship to practice their new craft by providing services to addicts who are still actively using medication and or substances and get some hope. And if they stay in it long enough, they can get trained as well without ever giving up the drugs, because they can earn a living. They can figure out a way to make money for themselves. And what they do with it, of course, is none of my business, but they can continue to this full circle of completeness of touching a lot of people for the least amount of money and getting something. And I'm, of course, always looking for sponsorship money from manufacturers that will help support this big idea of mine to be able to impact the most amount of people for the least cost.
You know, it really sounds fascinating, and certainly the various steps that you've gone through to come to FlexDebt Matt are really interesting. And with SAMHSA, extending a request for information and for proposals, that even adds to the legitimacy. I mean, so you've had Eli Lilly on the commercial side. You've had SAMHSA on the government side. So what does this all feel like for you?
Well, you know, what I failed to mention in that whole big diatribe was that we won that contest, too. SAMHSA's put out this contest. That was the app was submitted for a contest, and we were the grand prize winners. I mean, the MAT Edition was selected out of any number of other app developers that submitted their project, and they selected us. And essentially, we swept the five categories. I mean, I was the grand prize, and then three other categories that were also judged. So this was really well received and well recognized at the highest level. asked for legitimacy and validation and the effort that we put into it. And the feeling is very fulfilling, because I think for me, I suddenly, this word legacy started to pop up on my brain somewhere. Mm. I was like, okay, if I die tomorrow, because unfortunately people are dying all the time now. I mean, it just seems that every time you turn around, I passed 60 years old, and people I know, my generation, we did so much damage to our bodies unbeknownst to the intent of the impact of the drugs we used. You know, I'm struggling with, you know, liver disease, and finally got approved for medication for hepatitis C. And I'm not alone, because one in, 30 people of my generation have hepatitis C. So it's a rampant kind of problem. Other illnesses and the damage we did on our heart muscle and other areas of our body. So, you know, 63, 65, 68 years old, people I know, my peers are dying. And I'm like, well, if I die tomorrow, what is it going to look like? What is anybody going to remember me? Did I make a difference? Did I have any reason to exist? And I'm back full circle to that whole thing at adolescence. It's like, why am I here? What is my purpose? And so that's what it does for me, that no matter what, this stuff is going to live somewhere in the Wayback Machine on the internet. It's going to live somewhere that this person did something to make a contribution, because that was my greatest mission when I went through graduate school, was to make a contribution. I'm an Antioch rebel. That's where I went to graduate school for my master's degree. You know, that whole university without walls, and I'm not designed to sit in a classroom and sit there and take exams and think I learned something. I was never good at that. I failed at that. That's why I wound up in the theater. But I did learn through experience and experiential learning, and Antioch was the best fit for me. And I was just ran hard with that, and excelled, you know, being able to empower myself even then in early recovery to make those decisions and embrace the freedom and the responsibility of what freedom brings.
Tell me more about the Flex Deck Mat Edition. This is something that can be used by everybody who's listening right now, clinicians as well as potential clients?
Yes, clinicians can use it, but the administrative functionality is designed for the general public.
Okay.
You know, so the consumer or the people who are actively using can get suggested, like we do marketing to the different doctors that prescribe medication, to methadone clinics, for instance, so they can tell their clients that this is a tool to help them. Because the methadone clinics, I don't know if you're familiar with how they operate, but they have a very low counselor to patient ratio. They really don't have time to do much there in general because the cost and the expense. So we're trying to get people, not necessarily get them off of drugs, but give them that sense of hope that this isn't the end all be all, and that you can get connection with somebody, you know, as a professional coach, and then doing it no cost other than the time invested. Coaching is really the new methodology of being able to help people because it's cost effective. I dare say it's a little bit more than entry level. We're taking that whole life coaching model, adapting it to a recovery process. And again, coming back to recovery being generic, it's helping people establish an equilibrium and a balance. And we saw a lot of that when I went to 9/11 and provided services to the post-crisis survivors. Mm-hmm. As a licensed therapist in Florida, we're not allowed to practice therapy in New York.
Right.
So we had to go as consultants. That's what we were deemed as. And we went and did consulting, and we weren't doing therapy. We're doing assessments and evaluation and crisis management and you know, CISD and stuff. And it was really coaching in a lot of number of ways, and symptom identification and referral. So helping people move through their roadblocks, and a lot of them were emotional and traumatic and so forth. So that whole evolution of coaching and life coaching, and now adapted to whatever specialty you may be. This one is, we call it recovery, with a lot of focus on substance abuse training and mental health. So, you know, there's a number of pieces in there in terms of the curriculum, which is pretty extensive. There's over 100 hours of CEUs available that are certified by NADAC, which is the National Association of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors. So there's a lot of recognition and a lot of availability for a number of different components to get what they want. And everybody gets what they want. And it's a win-win-win, which is a very hard kind of formula in a business proposition. and to be, you know, win, lose, win, 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 win. It's like, what? I've never read about one of those. So I'm working on it.
You're right. Excuse me. It's very hard to hear about win, win, and win. Usually there's somebody who loses in this. But from what I'm hearing, you know, you really have looked at this from a 360 perspective and found a way to create something that is helpful to the people, to the helpers of the folks who are asking for help, to the folks who are asking for help, and to the clinicians and to the companies that are who say they're in the business of helping as well.
Exactly. And so if we can get the sponsors that provide the medication, the people that make methadone or the people that provide the methadone, the people that make the Suboxone, the people that make Naloxone, all those different brands, you know, like I mentioned, people go to trade shows, these companies go to trade shows and spend ridiculous amounts of money. And I'm not asking, you know, and I don't want to make this sound like a pitch or anything, but the amount of money that I'm asking for to help offset the expense of this concept is very little in terms of their big grand scheme of marketing budget. So for anybody that may hear this, please take a look, see, because we can make an impact. We can make a dent. We can make a difference and skew that needle, you know, just a little bit, because unfortunately everybody knows somebody now. It's not a 2 or 3 or 5 degree kind of experience of substance abuse in this country. Everybody knows somebody, and it's a 1 degree theory. And it could be, you know, in my house, I have two of my children are in, well, depending on what day it is, in recovery or not. And that's, you know, coming from an expert and coming from a person that was a drug-free home, et cetera. So nobody's immune. I mean, that's the reason I disclosed that. I mean, there's no immunity to this.
Right.
And now they're dying. The people, they're dying in one injection, and they're dying because the purity of the heroin is so high. The DEA took, you know, the oxycodones out of circulation and reduced the supply because it was out of control. So now the heroin, you know, is so pure, and then they're adding the fentanyl and the fentanyl compounds and all the carfentanil. I mean, it's just frightening. It's a very frightening proposition to be actively injecting drugs these days, because you're very likely to not wake up after the next shot, more so than any other time in the history of opiates on the street. And they can't keep up. The demand is exceeding the available services to help combat it.
Dr. Jonas, you know, the work that you're doing is so amazing. Is, as we close out our conversation today, is there a best way for folks to get in touch with you? And if you would again let folks know about the apps that are available at no cost.
Thank you. Thank you for that opportunity. Free downloads at the App or Play Store for FlexDeck Matte Edition. There's also FlexDeck Wellness Edition, and that is available for institutions or agencies to use. All that information is readily available on the internet at flexdeck.net, FlexDeck.net. I can be reached, and I'm readily available at Jonas@SoberNetwork.com via email, and I'm more than welcome to respond to everything that comes in. And
wonderful.
If you really want to talk to me, and then I'm more than happy to share my number, which is 561-441-5004. And look forward to hearing from all of your listeners.
Wonderful. Thank you again so much, Dr. Jonas, for the work that you have started to do, for the work you continue to do, and quite frankly, for your candor throughout our conversation today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it's available to you on demand 24/7 by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org, or you can download the MindTalk app from the iTunes store. And folks, I want you to always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.